It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4 to 1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
Terror and mass immigration in Europe. Muslim extremism and radical Islamic gangs, rape and murder, beheadings and shootings, millions of people living in fear while elected leaders do nothing.
Documentary filmmaker Michael Hansen dives deep into the problem with his new documentary, Killing Europe. With all the problems plaguing Europe, why does nobody seem to be doing anything about it?
This wave of people coming into Europe, and we're talking about by the hundreds of thousands, if not millions, in 1 year.
We have seen gangs of Muslim men overrunning towns in Europe where they say they are looking for better jobs, but that doesn't seem to be the case.
What's going on in reality is that a majority of these migrants coming in are not really actually working.
What's even more disheartening about the issue is you can't even speak about it without being called a racist.
There is a big taboo in Europe to address any issues regarding the consequences of mass immigration, and particularly illegal immigration, because you know, the first thing you're going to be accused of is you're going to be accused of being a racist.
You can go through certain neighborhoods in Europe right now, and it looks like a war zone.
When you go into these no-go zones, what you'll see is, in Sweden, for instance, you'll see burned-out cars in the streets like it was a war zone.
In New York, I'm Christopher Carter, One America News.
All right, One America News did a great kind of mini report on that, but it's a very big subject, and you've heard me talk about it before. Recently, you know, the president got in trouble because he tweeted some photos or some videos of supposed Islamic bad behavior in various countries of Europe, and the blowback was enormous. And no one talked about what was in the videos. They just talked about how horrible it was that the president was showing this Islamophobia, and so it went. But as much of blowback as we get in this country for criticizing Islam, and we certainly do get it, remember when President Obama went to the UN and one of the first things he said in his second term was the future does not belong to those that criticize the prophet? And we were scratching our heads saying, what is he talking about? He was talking about silencing anyone who criticizes Islam. Well, if we think we've come a long way on this issue, Europe is far and away ahead of us, as you probably well know. Our next guest grew up in Austria, the beautiful country we all kind of visualize when you think of the movie Sound of Music. Elizabeth Sabadich-Wolf is in the United States right now, but Austria is her home country, and she has a story to tell, and I want her to tell it to you. So, Elizabeth, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's an honor to be on your show.
Elizabeth, you know, honestly, Americans, when we think of Austria, we do think of the Sound of the Music. We think of the Alps. We think of singing music, great music out of Vienna with the great composers. We think of gorgeous lakes. We think of cleanliness. We also think of World War II and, you know, the fact that Adolf Hitler was Austrian. We could think of a number of things, but I'd be curious to know what it was like for you growing up in Austria.
Sandy, I have to correct you there because I didn't grow up in Austria. I was very fortunate to grow up, you know, spent part of my childhood in the United States. In I actually went to kindergarten in New York, and I attended grade school and 2 years of high school in Chicago, Illinois. And in between, I also spent a number of years in Iran, and I was... I want to say lucky enough. Maybe I wasn't so lucky, but I experienced the transition from Iran as a fairly Western-oriented country to a Islamic dictatorship, a theocracy under Ayatollah Khomeini. And if I'm asked about what got me into this business, quote-unquote, that I'm in right now, it is definitely those years in Iran that paved the way for who I am right now and what I'm doing right this moment. Yes, go ahead.
Well, let me ask you then to explain, because Austria is your home now. Your husband is a doctor. I understand that you worked for the government there. So what is your tie to Austria?
Well, look, I've always been an Austrian citizen. My dad is currently a retired diplomat. So he was posted to all of these places, which made it possible for me to experience all sorts of cultures. So when I'm called a hater and a xenophobe xenophobe is actually the word that I want to refer to. It's totally far from the truth, because I was always the foreigner in these countries, and even in my own home country of Austria, I was sort of an outsider and a foreigner too, because I spoke a different dialect of German, and I didn't share the background that the other kids in school got. So. Yeah, that's the story right now. My husband is currently serving in the Austrian military. He's a surgeon, and he is also in charge of all the military hospitals in Austria.
Wow, and you have kids, right? You have kids that you're raising in Austria?
I have one beautiful daughter, and she is the reason I'm doing all this, because I want her to grow up and know what freedom is all about. But I have to tell you, I'm failing at this miserably right now, because due to the migration issue in Vienna and the security situation, she has to go to school every morning armed with a pepper spray, which she's actually not allowed by law to carry because she's under 18.
I want to hear all about that, but I want to ask you another question first, just to set the table here a little bit. So you were living in Austria, your husband's a doctor, you're raising your daughter, and I'm just curious to know when you started first seeing some sort of change in Austria in terms of its demographic and culture. When did you start seeing that? What was your first alarm?
That's a very easy question for me to answer. From 1997 to 2000, I was living in Kuwait for the second time. I was working at the Austrian embassy at the time, and diplomat, I was allowed home leave once a year. And when I returned home for the first time after a year in Kuwait, I rode the metro. And I saw the demographic changes for the first time. So that would be, I would say, 1998. And the reason for this is also easy to explain. If you look at history, you will see that the Bosnian War took place in 1995. And Austria welcomed or took in a high number of refugees from the Bosnian War. And most of the Bosnians, of course, are Muslims. So that's how you started to see those changes in the streets.
Okay. All right, so you start to see this, and you are, as you said, a diplomat by your own description and for the Austrian government. So you have respect of your peers. Have respect in... No?
I have to interrupt. I'm no longer a diplomat. I left the diplomatic service after I returned from Libya in late 2001. I am simply a housewife, a mother, a daughter to my parents, and a wife to my husband right now. And it is my duty in life to protect my daughter.
Yes, but you were a diplomat. And so the point is that you were highly respected. And so then... Now I understand even more fully by your explanations of where you have lived, Elizabeth, why your understanding of Islam goes so deep. So you started then, as you were seeing these changes, you start doing seminars and lectures on Islam and its effects on the culture in about 2008. Is that right?
That is right. I started doing that in 2008, because remember, I had my daughter in the meantime, and I also finished my degree, my university degree. So I started giving those seminars in early 2008, and then was infiltrated. One of these seminars was then subsequently infiltrated by a left-wing magazine and secretly recorded. And the result of these transcriptions of the tapes were taken forwarded to the public prosecutor's office, which then pressed charges.
All right. So, and in the content, well, when you first started doing these seminars, were they well received? Were people coming and attending and taking
Absolutely.
Notes and asking
yes.
questions?
Absolutely. The reason why this young journalist infiltrated was that these seminars started, filling up fairly, quickly and relatively high numbers. Okay, I'm talking instead of seven or eight people, it was already all of a sudden, 30, 35 people. So we're still talking small numbers. But I guess they wanted to nip everything in the bud and destroy these seminars before they even got started properly.
And so when you actually, the point upon, they did a transcription or a recording of your seminar, and it was reported, and you were charged with, what was the term? A criminal...
incitement to hatred.
Incitement to hatred. And that was over the discussion then of Muhammad's marriage to a six-year-old girl who he, in the, is it the Hadith, where it says that he...
Yes, it's in the Hadith, but at first it was just incitement to hatred because of the entire seminar. And at the second hearing, the judge saw that this was not going to be sustainable because the recordings were played back and made it very clear that it wasn't any incitement at all to be found on the tape. The judge then, at her own discretion, added a second charge, which was denigration of religious teachings of a legally recognized religion, and that was followed because I had said, "What do you call the behavior of Muhammad towards a six-year-old girl?" And then when he consummated the marriage when she was nine, if not pedophilia. I was actually looking for another word. I was not accusing him of pedophilia. I was looking for another word to describe these actions.
All right. So then you were found guilty of denigration of religious beliefs
yes.
of a legally recognized religion. And that now, Elizabeth, this is a little foreign to us, the wording and also just the concept of it. We have religious freedom here. We have a First Amendment. But this passed in Austria 40 years ago, and I'm guessing it had something to do with the with the Holocaust. Is that correct?
No, that's not correct. The law is actually much older. It was passed in the 19th century, and it was amended. Well, first it included all the other religions, such as Christianity and Judaism and all the others, but it was amended in 1912, to include members of the Hanafite rite of the Islamic faith. And the reason for this is that the Austrian-Hungarian Empire had basically invaded Bosnia, Herzegovina, and had to incorporate the army of Bosnia into the Austrian army. So that's why there is a so-called law on Islam that governs the relationship between Muslims or the Islamic faith community and the Austrian government.
How interesting. How interesting. Yeah. So Elizabeth, by the way, my guest is Elizabeth Sabadich-Wolf. We're just starting with her story. She was found guilty of this crime, denigration of religious beliefs of a legally recognized religion. She was sentenced to time in jail and also fined. We want to talk about that. We also want to talk about what's happening in Austria now. She alluded to it in regard to her daughter, but that's just a tiny tip of the iceberg. So stay tuned. This is Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Ain't been a war, ain't been It was supposed to be an interfaith concert to bring Christianity and Islam together. Muslim imam began his call to prayer. He was interrupted by a small woman in the balcony proclaiming that Jesus Christ is Lord of Germany and saying, "I break this curse." She also invoked the name of Martin Luther and warned the audience that what was happening was a lie. It happened at the Memorial Church of the Reformation in the Rhineland city of Speyer, built to honor Martin Luther. This isn't just a church. It's a monument to the Protestant Reformation and a memorial to the spiritual transformation of Germany as a nation. And it was at this spiritual landmark that a Muslim imam was invited to give the call to prayer in a concert, when the brave German woman, whose real name is Heidi Mundt, heard about the event, she prayed.
I was asking Jesus, I said, "Lord, shall I go there?"
She grabbed her German flag emblazoned with the words, "Jesus Christ is Lord," and she went to the concert, still not sure what she would do when she got there. Then the Muslim call to prayer began, and Heidi said she felt something rising up inside her.
I would call it an holy anger. And then I rose my flag and I was proclaiming that Jesus Christ is Lord over Germany.
Jesus Christus allein ist Herr über Deutschland. Ich zerbreche diesen Fluch.
And she repeated the words of Martin Luther in 1521 after he refused to recant his faith in Scripture alone. "Here I stand, I can do no other." She was thrown out of the church.
They should have thrown the imam out of the church and not me, because I'm a believer in Jesus Christ, but he serves another God.
All right, that was Dale Hurd of CBN, and that's not a new clip. You may recall we interviewed Heidi Mundt right after that happened. It was an incredible story. Of course, that's Germany, but the neighboring state, I guess it would be like Wisconsin, Illinois maybe, is Austria. To Germany, and they have their own story to tell. And my guest today is Elizabeth Sabadich Wolf, who's telling her story. Elizabeth, you were found guilty. Did you go to jail?
No, I wanted to, but I couldn't because there were some legal steps in between that prevented me from going to jail. But they're unimportant, so I won't go into them. I grudgingly paid the fine after I was found guilty. Actually, after the verdict was upheld, all the way up to the Supreme Court, which then meant I had to pay the fine, but I never gave up, and I took the case to the European Court of Human Rights, which is kind of ironic because it's because I'm everything but a globalist, and this court is actually a supranational court, but if this court, throws out the verdict, and Austria will get in trouble because they might have to amend the law. That will be all worth it. So I'll be patient, and I'm hoping that we'll get a verdict soon.
All right. So that's the European Court of European Rights, which is what we're
a European Court of Human Rights.
Oh, okay.
And they're traditionally very pro free speech.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Well, that surprises me, and that's actually good news. We all know, you don't actually have to spend a lot of time convincing Americans that there is a political correctness that's crippling the United States now. But I don't think they probably understand how bad it can be, Elizabeth. It can be a lot worse, and we can actually be criminalized. At least Europeans are being criminalized for speaking out, as you were.
Yes.
Let's talk a little bit about Austria now. Because, let's just talk about the effect on the culture that you're seeing. And first of all, what percentage would you say of Austrian population are now Muslim immigrants?
Well, the official figures the absolute figures would be, according to official statistics, 700,000, which I will dispute, and I will say we now have a population of about 8.6 million, and I would venture a guess that the Muslim population is about 1.1 million.
All right, so that doesn't sound, that seems like manageable, but you I heard you recently describe what you are experiencing living in Austria, the differences, even with, let's just say it is 1.1 million, one-eighth of the population. What's different now?
You know, 1.1 million out of 8.6 million is a whole lot. And they are so strong already. They know that they're winning this, that the changes seen on the street, in the streets of Vienna, even in the neighborhood that I live in. Let me explain my neighborhood. I live in an affluent neighborhood in Vienna. I have to thank my parents for that. I didn't do anything about that. It really is a very affluent neighborhood. And you, all of a sudden, in the last month, I would say 6 months or so, you would see more and more Turkish supermarkets popping up all over the place. And then my husband would get off the tram, and he would walk towards our apartment, and he would have three or four headscarved women in front of him, and he watched them actually walk into apartment buildings on his way to our own apartment. So now these women, probably families, are being moved into apartment buildings that have until then not had any Muslims or any other non-Viennese or non-Austrians. So slowly, incrementally, you know, the demographics and the community is being changed. Now, from my own experience, I'll tell you, my husband, my daughter, and I live in also in an apartment building with just one apartment next door to us. And the apartment is now, it was empty for a couple of months, and it now has new tenants, and they are Iraqis, two men, and my daughter is going to be 13 in 2 weeks. So you can understand that I'm quite worried, sometimes very, very frightened about the changes, because now it's dark outside. And, what happens when summer comes and she runs around in her short skirts and you have these men next door. Why are they living there? Let me tell you something. The rent for this apartment is 1,200 euros without utilities. That would be about 1,500 US without utilities. You're telling me, or the city government, the authorities are telling me that two men who are refugees from Iraq can afford an apartment on the money they collect from the government. They have no intention of learning German. They have no intention of assimilating into Austrian culture. And yet they are living in an apartment that costs this much money. Now, what really, really angers me is that my husband has to work about 60 hours a week. And he doesn't even make nearly as much to afford an apartment like that. If we didn't have my parents to support us, we would not be able to afford an apartment.
And your husband's a doctor, I have to add again.
And my husband's a doctor.
Yeah,
correct.
So Elizabeth, now I heard rumors that a lot of these refugees going into Europe are being given tons of money by the United Arab Emirates. Do you know anything about
that?
That's
true. I've heard about that. And I actually have, I actually rode with a cab driver, I'd say about a year ago. And he said that when the Great Migration crisis started in August, September of 2015, he told me he actually went to the then Hungarian border and picked up refugees and drove them to the German border. And he said he had never, ever seen this many 500 euro bills. And he asked those refugees, where do you get the money from? And they told him from the United Arab Emirates. They're just handed the money.
All right, so Elizabeth, here you are living in this, what you feel is a safe area in Vienna. for, on purpose, because you want to be safe. You want your daughter to be safe. And now they've moved refugees in next door to you, two men. And it's not even just your daughter. It's also you. That's right. If they figure out exactly what your activity is, there's danger. And so, all right. And let's talk about, I have, in fact, if we'd had time, I would have played a clip about the rape, Sweden, as I understand, is now the rape capital of Europe. Now, what are you seeing anything like that in Austria?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. I read, you know, a lot of Austrian newspapers every morning, and there's more and more reports of rapes, gang rapes by Afghans and Syrians and Iraqis. It's interesting that it's always the same nationality, so there must be a pattern. But the problem is when you want to know what causes the patterns, that's where the legal system will catch you. They will actually prosecute you for wanting to look at closely at the reasons for this rape epidemic. The numbers in Germany are actually much higher, and the stories coming out from Germany are heartbreaking. There's so many deaths, so many murders, so many tragic stories. For instance, you have a grandma whose pension was so low that she was forced to steal. She had to go. She had to shoplift, actually, and she was about, I think, 75 or 80, and they actually locked her up because of that. And no appeal, there was no appeal possible. They locked her up. And then you have refugees getting away with literally murder and rape. On the other hand, you have grandmas being locked up because their pensions are they can't sustain their lives.
It's an injustice that's really unspeakable. I want to talk to you about Austria and the church. Now, whereas Germany has been Lutheranism is the church of Germany. In Austria, it's Catholic. I don't think, is it a state church, Elizabeth, the Catholic Church?
No, it's not a state church. It does enjoy the protection of the law, like Islam does, but it's not a state church.
All right, so. But how would you characterize the spiritual condition of Austria now? And I'm not talking about the influx of Islam. I'm talking about the Christian, what once was a stronghold of Catholicism and Christian faith. How would you describe it now?
Well, it's greatly undermined by cultural Marxism, and to give you an example, just this morning I received news that the Austrian Supreme Court has given permission for same-sex marriages to be legal, and it just broke my heart because the traditional concept of a family is now completely changed and no longer, you know, husband, wife, and children, mom, dad, and a child. And I haven't seen any reaction from the church yet, but it doesn't seem like it's going to rattle their cages in any way, shape, or form.
It is amazing, isn't it, how the left and the Islamists work together. They're working together in Europe. They're working together here to completely transform. They're partners in this. It's just amazing.
I do
want to ask you about something before we run out of time here. This is Christmas time, and Austria is known for, so is Germany, for its Christmas markets and all of its beautiful Christmas ornaments and gifts and crafts. And so describe what's happening with that.
Well, the Christmas markets and the Christmas spirit are forced to change dramatically. I mean, if you think that life, you know, politicians want us to believe that life is just normal and nothing has changed and, you know, that we can't have, you know, it's the usual, we can't have the terrorists change our lives. We have to go on and live our lives the way we always do. But that's wrong. It's incorrect. It's a lie. It's a blatant lie because our lives have already changed so dramatically. And so it goes for the Christmas markets where you have all these barriers erected now and you have all those policemen patrolling more than ever before. And, you know, it's pathetic. They're telling us our lives haven't changed. Well, they have, and they have changed massively. And you have women and children afraid of going to these Christmas markets. I, for one, don't feel like going because I don't feel like, have all these police all over the place. This should be a festive time and not a time where I have to worry about being blown up by a bomb or maybe even, have a truck, all over me. I don't need that. So that's why I stay away. And I think that's very, very sad. So these politicians ought to be ashamed of themselves and they should be kicked out for telling us a lie. And the population actually knows exactly what's going on in this case, because if you look at our recent elections, we had general elections in Austria, and the tide has really shifted because now it's center-right and no longer center-left. The leftists are actually totally gone now.
Wow. Elizabeth Sabadich-Wolf, my guest today. Thank you, Elizabeth. We'll be right back. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Sandy Rios back with you. My special guest today is Elizabeth Sabadich-Wolf, who is, I'll get my country straight in a minute. I've been reading about Sweden so much that I keep wanting to say Sweden, but it is Austria that Elizabeth, that's her home country, the beautiful Austria. The land of God's great hand, really, in terms of beauty and, of course, music, inspiration. It's just legendary, and it's heartbreaking to see what's happening in Austria. Elizabeth, you've lived in Iran, you've lived in Libya, you've had tremendous experience, not only reading about Islam, obviously you're well-versed in it, you did these seminars, but you've lived in these countries. There are many now who will say, moderate Islam is good. There are a lot of moderate Muslims who don't fall into this category. Others say Islam is a peaceful religion. There are a lot of defenses. And I would just really like to know, after all that you've seen and the way your country's been affected, how would you describe Islam? How would you make it clear what the distinctions might be, if there are any?
Listening to you and trying to formulate an answer to this, well, I can tell it's difficult, but I think I think it should suffice if I quoted the Turkish president Erdogan, who says that the concept of, or I'm paraphrasing him, the concept of moderate Islam is offensive to all Muslims because Islam is Islam and nothing else. So I very much agree with President Erdogan on this, and given all my studies and my trips and my, you know, I lived in those countries, we can agree that there may be moderate Muslims, although I don't like the term because it doesn't denote anything, but Islam is certainly not moderate in any way, shape, or form, unless you want to call beheadings and wife beatings and child marriages in any way, shape, or form moderate. So that's the answer I can give you. I'm of the firm belief that Islam has never been moderate, it never will be moderate, and it never will be changed.
Well, certainly history sort of backs you up on that. When we follow the Ottoman Empire, the conquest, the Battle of the Crusades. We go back to what was happening here in this country in the Barbary Coast during Thomas Jefferson's time, and then, of course, back much further than that. Since Islam began, it's always been at war with the people around it. And so I think history does show that there's truth to what you're saying. Elizabeth, I'm wondering, allies in Europe. Gert Wilder, everyone knows who Gert is. I've certainly met him. He's a champion, but boy, has he paid the price? And then I think of Alian Hirsi, who has spoken out about Islam and has been in danger in Holland, and then coming to America, she's found danger. Have you found other allies? And maybe you can't even mention their names. Are there other allies for you?
Allies in Austria? No. There are some very close friends that I work with, but allies in that sense, no. I'm a one woman show in Austria, which is fine. I mean, that's something I have to deal with. But you know, people are scared. If you're taken to court and locked up, you don't want to speak out, and that's what's so dangerous in Europe right now, is that people simply don't want to speak up because they speak out because they're going to lose their job. They're going to lose everything they have. I mean, look at me. I lost my job. I mean, I'm lucky to, you know, about my husband, but other than that, it's not easy. So they're very clever, these European oligarchs and European non-elected officials, and they scare people into not doing anything. And they're very good at it.
What warning would you give to Americans listening? If you could have talked to Australians freely, you know, what? I don't know how many years behind you, maybe not even 10. I would say more like 5. If you were to give us any kind of warning of how to stop this, what would you say?
What would I say? Well, you know, First Amendment. That's the most important thing, First Amendment. If you don't have the First Amendment, you're going to lose everything you have.
Elizabeth, listen, thank you. We appreciate your time today. Elizabeth
Sabadich
Wolf. God bless
you
and keep you and keep your family safe. Thanks for your courage, Elizabeth.
Thank you. Thank you. Bye-bye, Sandy.
Bye-bye. Well, wasn't that some story? And, of course, Elizabeth ended her time with us talking about the importance of the First Amendment. What did she mean? Well, it's interesting to have someone from Austria commending our First Amendment to us, which guarantees the right of free speech, being able to say whatever you think, free especially political speech, free religious speech, proclaiming your faith, living your faith, freedom of a religion, not worship. Worship is just confining it to a building, but freedom of religion is living out your faith, which means that if you don't think that you can bake a wedding cake for a gay marriage, you shouldn't have to under the First Amendment. It also means that if you want to say that Jesus is Lord and you don't believe that Allah is, you should be able to say that. That means that if you think there's a problem with Islamic teaching that maybe promotes something really dreadful, certainly for women, and you can give examples of that, you have the right to say that. That's why our founding fathers came here, because they knew what it was like to live under tyranny, where you could not say what you thought, you could not criticize the king, and you surely could not exercise religious freedom. And so this is what was unique about the United States of America. We had a freedom of thought, freedom of practicing our faith, a freedom of speech that was nowhere else on the planet. In fact, no other country has a First Amendment. We have a First Amendment. We must fight for it. And the reason many of us are so exorcised about what's happening on college campuses, where there can't be any criticism of Islam, where there can't be any criticism of the homosexual lifestyle, of gay marriage, don't you dare. We are seeing an encroachment on our right to free speech, on our own ability to express ourselves and believe what we believe and live it and express it. We have lost so much of that, but it's not too late. And I think Elizabeth's warning to take back the First Amendment is certainly right on target. And I'm just encouraging you to, while you can, speak up, be honest, don't be afraid. Talk to your children, teach them what the truth is about all of these things. Get resources, talk to your neighbors, talk to your friends. Don't be shy, exercise your First Amendment. All right, this kind of ties into the decision that the Supreme Court made about President Trump's travel ban. Isn't it interesting? He simply wants to vet at a higher level people coming in from mostly Muslim countries. They're not all Muslim countries. North Korea is on the list of the travel ban as well, and other countries as well, but mostly Muslim, because guess what? Based on what Elizabeth said to us, Islamic teaching promotes the kinds of things we're seeing universally, whether it's the rape culture, whether it's the lack of respect for any other people and their faith, an unwillingness to assimilate, a rigidness, a harshness, a violence that we don't see in other religions. And so the president issued this travel ban, and of course you know what happened in the lower courts. He was criticized for being Islamophobic. His conversation on the campaign trail when he said we should make our borders safe. We should not let just anyone in. We should be careful. Was met with, he's xenophobic. He's Islamophobic. You fill in the blank. But just this week, or just recently, the Supreme Court made a big decision. Let's listen.
As you know, this is a small victory for the Trump administration. It stems from the president's executive order that he issued shortly after taking office. Again, the ban is now in effect. It affects six mostly Muslim countries. It applies to travelers coming into the U.S. from Chad, Iran, Libya, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen. Now, we should note here there were two justices who dissented from this decision, Justices Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Sonia Sotomayor. They would have left the lower court order stay in place. But because the Supreme Court, the rest of the justices, have ruled that this policy can take full effect, even as legal challenges continue in those lower courts. As those challenges continue, it would suggest, though, that once they make their way to the Supreme Court again, the Supreme Court would ultimately keep the latest version of the ban the Trump administration announced in September in place. Again, the Supreme Court will allow the Trump administration to fully enforce the travel ban to the United States from those six mostly Muslim countries, of course.
All right. So that, but you know, the thing of it is, there were seven justices who voted in favor of the president's travel ban. So I think that's good news. But here's the thing: I have to tell you, all of these big movements that are happening in Europe and in Britain, Brexit, the group in Germany that's fighting against Angela Merkel is gaining power. It's called Alternative for Germany because they are against this out of control illegal immigration. Out of control immigration, I guess for them it's legal because the European Union is forcing them to take in refugees. And I just want to say that in Germany, I just read an article that there's a small Jewish community in the West German city of Bochum announcing that they will no longer wear kippot because of attacks on them by Muslim youths. And so it's having its effect. Islam is having the effect of dominating Europe as it did during the Ottoman Empire, which is what exactly the goal is to reinstate the Ottoman Empire. I've heard that Erdogan, the president of Turkey, aspires to be the leader of this new Ottoman Empire. But Germany and the other countries have, because the European Union has demanded it, because of political correctness, have allowed unbelievable amounts of illegal immigrants, and of Muslim immigrants legally admitted because of the shame over not admitting them. And I was just reading an article called, it's a Pew Research did a poll on Europe's growing Muslim population. And they report that now, and of course, understand, these numbers are always low, just like they tell us in this country we have 12 million illegal immigrants. Really? I mean, it almost requires a laugh track. So based on that, these are the numbers that have been given out. In France, 8.8% of the population, Muslim. In Luxembourg, 3.2%. In Switzerland, 6.1%. In Germany, 6.1%. In Austria, according to Pew, 6.9%. And on it goes. But you contrast that with Poland, 0.1%. Hungary, 0.4%. Romania, 0.4%. There's a reason for that. That's because in Eastern Europe, where Poland and Hungary and Romania, you know, were freed from the Soviet Union. They are resisting the European Union, and they are securing their borders, and they are maintaining their culture. There's a huge resistance to what the rest of Western Europe has done. And so that may be the only hope for Europe to maintain its identity, is that Eastern Europe is refusing to play the game. And so this is what's happening in Europe, and I'm so glad we got to hear from Elizabeth today to tell her personal story. And I think putting it in context, of course, we must fight to preserve our identity. Not just because our identity, it's not wrong to do that as a nation, to want to be your own people and to preserve your national identity. We're getting so muted and so invaded by various cultures and populations that it's very hard now, I think, for our kids to even remember or know what it was like to be an American. And central to our culture, of course, is Judeo-Christian values and teaching. We have been the people of the book. That doesn't mean that everybody's embraced it, that everyone has bowed the knee to Christ, because it is a personal faith he requires, not a legalized general category identification. But even the fact that people identify broadly as Christians has created a certain set of values in this country, which has made this country the freest, most wonderful, most abundant, most prosperous country in the entire history of the world. And we have outsourced faith in Jesus Christ. We've sent more missionaries to countries. We have helped people, and we have poured millions of dollars into other countries, not requiring anything in return, not pursuing conquest, taking over people groups, but giving back of the abundance that we have experienced as people of the book. But that's changing, because people of another book are invading our country, and they are insisting that we are even allowed to even say that we believe that Jesus is the only King. He's the only Lord. We're not supposed to be able to say that, but we must. We must say that. We must, as Elizabeth suggested, embrace our First Amendment rights to express our faith and to live it fully. So that's the way it is in Europe, and that's the battle coming in the United States. Thanks for listening. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.